Well, this psalm is a psalm, Psalm 63, that perhaps we're kind of vaguely familiar with. We know little bits of the psalm. Maybe early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. But actually, those words are familiar from a number of different psalms, perhaps. These sentiments are here for us in many different parts of the Bible. In fact, when we read the Psalms, we get a very strong sense, don't we, that many of the authors, David not least among them, were those who continually, or at the very least frequently, expressed thoughts like these, that he wanted to be near to God, he wanted to know God's presence with him. So as we're studying and reflecting on our need for the presence of God, that's why we're turning again and again to psalms like these. I think it may be helpful for us this evening to split the psalm up into five sections that help us to see something of the path that David is traveling on. But before we do that, let's remind ourselves of the title of the psalm, because the title has not been added by English translators. It's part of the original psalms. That's not true for the rest of the Bible, but in the psalms, the bit that often comes before verse 1 is part of the original text. In this case, we're told, a psalm of David when he was in the wilderness of Judah. We're not sure exactly when that is. You know, David spent a lot of time not sitting comfortably in his palace at different times. But I think it's probably likely that this was relatively late on in his life, when Absalom had rebelled against him and he was forced to flee. The earlier part of his life, when he was on the run from Saul, tended to be in the hill countries and the mountains rather than the wilderness. So it's likely that this was during perhaps Absalom's rebellion. You can see, again in verse 11, there's a reference to the king, which does perhaps suggest it is a time when he himself was king. But whatever the situation, he's there in the wilderness. We could use the word desert. It's that kind of idea. It's a place where there's no water, really. There's no plants that are growing. It's a dry place. And as he's looking around at the scene around him, it obviously helps him to think about spiritual things as well. So I'm in this physically very dry and arid place, but how are things spiritually? It's a great question to ask, isn't it, ourselves? Well, here's my situation. Maybe it's a dark time. Well, okay, we're having a dark experience. But how am I spiritually? We're having a dry experience. Yeah, but how am I spiritually? That seems to be the question that David is asking, and the psalm really is his answer to that question. How am I spiritually? And there are five things, as we've mentioned, that he draws out in the psalm. The first one, he has a desire for God, looking at the first two verses in particular. He has a desire for God. O God, you are my God, early will I seek you. That's a pretty strong indication of desire, isn't it? What do you do first thing in the morning? Many of us, perhaps, we want a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. That's what we need first thing. We can't do anything else until we've had a cup of tea or coffee. That's what we want. That's what we desire. Maybe it's something different for you. But here for David, almost the first thing, as it were, when he wakes up in the morning, is he wants to know God's presence. Perhaps partly because he was in this very difficult situation in the wilderness of Judah. He knew that even more. Maybe perhaps we're too comfortable, think life is too easy, not enough problems in our lives that we don't seek God. But David certainly has this desire for God. It comes out even more clearly in the phrases that follow. My soul thirsts for you, my flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. It's very evocative, isn't it? As you can picture him perhaps in this wilderness. I wonder whether we sometimes allow our problems, perhaps compared to David, our relatively small problems, to get in the way of our seeking God. For David, it was the opposite. The fact that he was having problems meant it all the more important that he sought after God. You've probably heard the story of Martin Luther talking about praying and spending hours each day praying. and being asked, well, how on earth do you pray for that long when there's so much to do? To which Martin Luther replied something along the lines, it's because there's so much to do that I have to pray for that long. Whereas we might maybe feel, well, I have to rush off a prayer quickly because I've got loads to do. Wasn't his attitude. He felt he had to come to the Lord in prayer because there's no way he would accomplish what he needed to do otherwise. And maybe, therefore, what might be our lack of desire, Fod, comes perhaps from our lack of dependence on God. But here, David, it seems, was depending on God, and that fueled his desire for God. And you can see in verse 2 that this desire for God is not just something theoretical, but it's something also that he's put into practice. I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. Now, he's not talking about his present actions at the moment because he's in the wilderness of Judah. He's not in the city of Jerusalem. So he's not saying, oh, when I got up this morning, I popped down to the temple to pray. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying instead is this has been his experience. This is what he's known over the years, that he has looked for you in the sanctuary. And he's seen the Lord's power and glory. It seems, as it were, that is fueling his desire for God. That's why he desires God. Those who grew up in times maybe of revival or who can remember powerful works of God and works of the Holy Spirit maybe sometimes have a greater desire for God than those of us who haven't had those experiences. Now, that's not an excuse, of course. The point that I'm making simply is that the more we desire God and the more we find our desire fulfilled, the more the desire grows. And we may feel perhaps at the moment, well, I only have a small desire for God. Well, that's not going to increase unless we satisfy at least that small desire, which David did here by looking for God. There's something active here. Early in the morning, I will seek you. David is doing something about his desire. And it may be that our desire is weak, but even if it is weak, it must be something that we act upon and that we put into practice. I wonder if I was to ask you, just to think in your own mind, how this week have you put into practice your desire for God? What have you done to satisfy that desire? How have you drawn near to God? It's a good question for all of us to ponder. So that was the first thing I think we could learn from Psalm 63, David's desire for God. But there's something else here, this time from verses 3 through to 5, David's praise for God. His praise for God. It comes out very clearly, doesn't it, in verse 3. Because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you. Continues in verse 4, thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. And it continues in verse 5, my soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. So you can see David's got this wonderful praise for God. Now again, let's underline the circumstances. David's having a rough time, to say the least. He's in the wilderness of Judah. There may well be effectively a rebellion on his hands against him as king. And yet, in the midst of that, in the midst of people seeking his life, he's effectively able to say, well, that doesn't matter compared to your loving kindness. It doesn't matter what men may say or do. Your loving kindness is better than life, and because of that, I shall praise you. I'm not praising you because of my circumstances. I'm not doing what Satan accused Job of doing, only loving God because you give me nice stuff. No, David loves God because of who he is and because of his attributes and his character. Your loving kindness is better than life. And again, this comes to action now, doesn't it? You can see that in Psalm 63 and verse 4. I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name. Again, it's that action. It's true for all of us that God's loving kindness is better than life. It's not true for only some of us. It's not true only part of the time. It's true for all of us all of the time. And the question again is, well, how have we transformed that into action? What have we done about that? What have we done about the fact that God's loving kindness is better than life? Have we done as David did? Praised God, blessed him, lifted up his hands in his name. Now you may think there in verse 4, well, there's some kind of charismatic worship going on. That's what happens. I don't know whether you're doing that in the Christian Union earlier on. Lifting up hands in your name. There's nothing wrong with such a thing in praise and worship, but that's not primarily what David is talking about. He's not saying, well, as I was sitting in the wilderness of Judah, I was singing a song and lifting my hands up. In that sense, it's not simply what he's talking about. What he's talking about here and what hands often represents in biblical theology are the actions that we do. So we talk, for example, don't we, about in the Bible, about our head and our hands. Head is what we think. Our hands are what we do. So what David here is saying when he says, I lift up my hands in your name, he's not simply saying, well, I was singing and raising my arms in the air. He's saying much more than that. I'm putting that into practice in my life. You can see from the way that I live and the things that I do that I'm blessing you. And as a consequence of all that, you can see in verse 5 that David's soul will be satisfied with marrow and fatness. Now, I don't know how you might react if you were to receive a meal full of marrow and fatness. Probably some people would push it aside and go for the low-fat option. But of course, in David's day, fatness and marrow and that kind of thing in food was a sign of richness. They were often struggling, perhaps not the king, but certainly normal people would be struggling to get enough calories in their food. Fatness was a vital, important part of the diet. Without that, you would wither away and maybe even die. So what David is saying here is, my soul shall be satisfied as if I'd eaten the very best food there was, the very thing that was best for me. And again, there's a poignancy here, isn't there? As here is somebody who very likely has, as the king, has been eating the richest of fare and now finds himself struggling for survival in the wilderness of Judah. And he could easily, and I think probably I might be tempted to do this, maybe you would as well, be kind of longing for that physical food that we used to enjoy whilst we're kind of scratching around eating, I don't know what you can find in the wilderness, dead birds or bits of grass or whatever he could get his hands on, I don't know. But instead of that, he's saying, no, spiritually, I'm satisfied as much as I was physically satisfied earlier, and therefore my mouth's shall praise you. So that desire for God has shown itself in praise for God, verses 3 to 5. And then the third section, verses 6 through to 8, is satisfaction in God. Satisfaction in God. So the scene changes now in verses 6 through to 8, because whilst the psalm began in verse 1 with, early will I seek you, now in verse 6, when I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. So this is clearly what David is talking about here is not something that happens just for a few moments throughout the day, but something that happens constantly, as it were, whatever the time of day. He's remembering him, even when he's asleep, he's meditating, thinking on the Lord. I wonder how we spend our final moments, as it were, once our head is on the pillow, but before we go to sleep. What are we thinking of then? All the things we have to do tomorrow. A little recap maybe of the things that we've done that day. Or maybe we've just got the radio on or we fall asleep reading a book or what have you. But David was doing none of those things. He, it seems, quite deliberately and consciously turned his thoughts to the Lord at the end of the day, so that he deliberately and consciously started and ended his day with God. Why would you do that? Well, he does that because he's satisfied with God or in God. Look at verse 7. Because you have been my help. Because you have been my help. That's why he does it. So I'm not saying to us this evening, oh look, we should end our day thinking of God so that we get good things tomorrow. And that's not what David's saying. David is saying, I do end my thinking each day with God because he's been helping me until now. That's what he thinks about. He has been his help. And that's why he rejoices. Verse 7 makes that clear. That's why in verse 8, his soul, it's a lovely phrase here, my soul follows close behind you. You've had that experience perhaps from children, perhaps from others who kind of tag along. Sometimes we use the expression, don't we, following me like a dog. And maybe a little child who just kind of follows you through the house, won't leave you alone because they want something or they want to be with you, whatever it is. And this seems to be the idea here of David. That's what he's doing with God. He doesn't want to let him out of his sight. He wants to follow him wherever he goes. And that's what David's doing. It's what we should all be doing. And his right hand, of course, upholds me. Now, the question, therefore, to ask ourselves under this heading is, well, are we satisfied in God as David was? So David is in the wilderness of Judah. He's probably, verse 9 makes clear, people trying to kill him. And yet, in the midst of all that, he's satisfied. Not his circumstances, but his soul. Why? Again, verse 7, you have been my help. Now let's think about ourselves. Has God been our help? Well, yes, of course. We could list a dozen ways, couldn't we, in which God has been our help. You could easily, if I gave you 5 minutes or so, write down a list of 20, 30, 40 things of ways in which God has answered your prayers, couldn't you? But of course, you could do more than that, because maybe right at the top of your list or underlined or whatever would be that sense, hang on, Jesus Christ died for my sins. He hasn't just helped me to get a job or to feed the family or whatever it might be. God the Father sent Jesus Christ the Son to die on the cross in my place, your place, that we might spend all eternity with him. He has been our help. And really, that's where all this stems from for David, because God has been his help. He's had that experience. It's not something theoretical. It's something he knows. And if David knows that, how much more do we know it? Because our spiritual experience is greater than David's spiritual experience. David didn't know that the Son of God had died for his sins, not in that sense. He didn't even know the theological truth. He believed, certainly, that God somehow would do something that would mean that his sins could be forgiven and he could go to heaven. He certainly was trusted in God for that, but he didn't know that what God was going to do was send his own Son to die in our place. And he certainly wasn't able to trust in the crucified Messiah in the way that we can. And yet, because David had been chased round Israel and further afield by King Saul, he knew what it was that God had been his help. But our spiritual experience is greater than David's human experience. And yet maybe we don't see it that way. Maybe David was more grateful than we are, perhaps even. Because what we cannot see with our human eyes, we perhaps don't perceive as important. But if David could be satisfied in God, how much more ought we be satisfied in God, who has dealt with our very worst sins and our greatest need? So desire for God, praise for God, satisfaction in God. Verses 9 and 10 now, confidence in God. Confidence in God. Those who seek my life to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for jackals. So here's David. He's in the wilderness. People are trying to kill him. But actually, he's not all that worried about that because he's trusting God. And God's made promises to him about that his throne and his kingdom and so on will last forever. He understands that he's not immortal in terms of this earth, but he's got confidence in God that God will see out his promises, and God, then it's okay. It's okay. It's a wonderful attitude to have, isn't it, even in the darkest and most difficult of times. But I think David can only have that attitude because of what's gone before, because of his satisfaction in God, because of his praise for God, because of his desire for God. And if we're to be ready to follow in David's footsteps, as it were, then if we're to be able to keep trusting God no matter what the circumstances, we need to do as David did, as we've seen already under this heading of satisfaction, to sit in the shadow of his wings, to be close to him, as verse 8 also explains. It's that that gives David confidence. You've perhaps seen of Christians, maybe you've experienced it yourself too, of some great traumatic, terrible event happening, and yet there seems to be, in all the upset and the sadness and the confusion maybe, there seems to be a peace, perhaps even a joy. Where does that come from? It comes from knowing God. It comes from having confidence in him that no matter what happens, God is in control. And the final heading for us then from verse 11, we've seen desire for God, praise for God, satisfaction in God, confidence in God. Finally, verse 11, joy in God. The king shall rejoice in God. Everyone who swears by him, by God, shall glory, but the mouth of those who speak lies shall be stopped. So David now is finishing by saying, I'm not just confident in what God will do, but right now I am rejoicing and I will keep rejoicing in God. Everyone who swears by him shall glory. We're obviously not talking about swearing in the sense that people use that word today. We're talking about swearing in the sense of swearing an oath. You used to, obviously, in David's day and even a few hundred years ago in this country, you would swear an oath of loyalty to the king or to whoever it might be. And here what David is saying is that anyone who swears that oath of loyalty to God shall glory. So you can imagine perhaps, and this would be a particularly powerful picture for David himself as a king, but you're a kind of fairly ordinary person in a kingdom. But the king is asking for people to come and fight for him and to be on his side. Maybe there's a rebellion, as there was a rebellion against David. And in that situation, the king is seeking people to come and swear an oath to him. And that's what you do. You go to the king and you swear an oath of loyalty. And as a consequence of that, you're given the shield, as it were, of the king to wear, and you're visibly, noticeably on his side. And then the king wins a great victory. Well, you're part of that great victory. You may not have waved your sword in anger in the battle that went on, but nonetheless, you're in the king's colors. You're on the king's side. And as the king has won his victory, then all of those who swore an oath to the king share in his glory. And that's the picture of a Christian, of any believer in God, Old or New Testament. That we, as it were, by God's grace, have sworn an oath of loyalty to the Lord, and we will share, therefore, in his glory. We shall glory as he glories. And of course, those who oppose him, their lives will be stopped. So a challenge, I think, for us, as we're seeking the face of God, do we have this desire? Are our hearts full of praise? Are we satisfied in God when we remember what he's done in Christ? Are we confident in him? Are we joyful because of what he has done? I don't want the emphasis here tonight to be a sense of, well, I'm not sure these things are really true of me. I ought to desire more. I ought to praise more. I ought to be more satisfied. I ought to be more confident. I ought to be more joyful. I'm sure that is true of you, just as it's true of me. It's true of all of us, isn't it, in that sense? But the point of this psalm is not to say, oh, isn't David a faithful believer? That's not the point of the psalm, is it? That's not why David wrote the psalm, is it? And therefore, that's not the point of my sermon either. The point of this psalm is not to say David is a faithful believer. What is it? Look at verse 1. It's to say God is a faithful God. And therefore, I'm not asking this evening whether your desire for God or praise for God is what it could be or should be. I'm asking us simply to look to the Lord. And as we look to the Lord, our desire will increase. Our praise will come naturally. We will be more satisfied and more confident and more joyful. But we will do that as we look to Him, rather than doing that as we look to ourselves. Yes, it's a call for action, to seek, to praise. But it's not a call to act on our own and in our own strength. It's a call to look to God. So as we have a time of prayer later in the meeting, that's an opportunity, isn't it? Especially in prayer, to look to the Lord for help and strength. And help and strength not just for tonight, but for the days and weeks to come. That indeed God may help us to desire and praise and be satisfied, confident and joyful in Him.